La plupart de vous, d'entre vous connaissez déjà Peter Felsner, donc pour ceux qui ne le connaîtraient pas, juste quelques mots d'introduction. Il a commencé par travailler sur des sites du Rabour. Et il a travaillé également en Syrie à Tel Mozan, mais l'endroit où il s'est fait le connaître de la façon la plus large, c'est bien sûr à Tel Mishrife Katna, où il a eu cette chance incroyable de découvrir des tombes royales intactes, ce qui, dans le monde mésopotamien, n'est pas si fréquent, et de façon générale, et avec son équipe, ce qui est remarquable, c'est ensuite toutes les publications qui sont sorties rapidement, parce que ça ne suffit pas de faire de belles découvertes, il faut aussi trouver les équipes compétentes pour traiter tous les différents aspects, il faut pousser tous ces spécialistes à publier de façon coordonnée, et je dois dire que pour moi, il y a la chance de la découverte, mais ensuite il y a le mérite de son exploitation. Et de ce point de vue-là, je trouve que c'est quelque chose qui a été tout à fait remarquable. Et puis, malheureusement, depuis une dizaine d'années, il n'est plus possible de travailler en Syrie. Et donc, pour toute une série d'équipes, la question s'est posée de savoir où travailler. Et il se trouve que, j'allais dire par chance, c'est le moment où, au contraire, dans le Kurdistan irakien, des possibilités de travail se sont offertes. Et donc, Peter Felsner a entamé la fouille du site de Bassetki, et c'est ce dont il va nous parler aujourd'hui. Donc je suis très heureux qu'il ait accepté de revenir à Paris, puisqu'il était déjà venu invité par les amis de Larsa il y a quelque temps, dans des circonstances qui n'avaient pas permis à beaucoup de personnes d'interagir avec lui. C'était même davantage via un écran, et donc là je suis très content que vous soyez ici, et comme ça on pourra ensuite avoir un dialogue, et puis après prolonger un petit peu cette rencontre. Peter, merci beaucoup, et c'est à toi.
Oui, cher Dominique, cher Nele, chers collègues, mesdames, messieurs, d'abord je tiens à vous remercier Dominique pour m'inviter ici au Collège de France, cette institution fameuse de la recherche. C'est un grand honneur pour moi, et aussi c'est un grand plaisir de retourner à Paris. Quand nos collègues au Collège de France ont l'accent de recherche sur la période paléo-babylonienne et en général sur la philologie assyriologique, j'ai décidé de mettre l'accent de ma présentation aussi sur les deux périodes, la période paléo-babylonienne et aussi la période médio-assyrienne. Ça veut dire la période d'où on a trouvé un archive médio-assyrien. Et en tout, j'ai aussi essayé de donner un rapport sommaire sur les résultats les plus importants de nos fouilles. Avant de commencer, je dois vous dire que je ne vais pas parler en langue française, parce que mon français n'est pas assez fort pour le faire. N'inquiétez pas, aussi, je ne vais pas parler en allemand, mais j'ai décidé de parler en anglais, qui est le plus facile pour moi, et j'espère que tout le monde peut bien entendre. OK, so now I will change to English, and let me start with the first slides. As Dominic has already said in his introduction, the site of Bassetki is located in the Kurdistan region of Iraq, in northern Iraq, the Kurdistan region, which is divided into four regions. And we are working in the northernmost region, which is the region and province of Duhuk, the northernmost province of Iraq. This is the autonomous region of Kurdistan within Iraq. So the Duhuk province is bordering Turkey and slightly even bordering Syria. And the reason why we work there actually are the excellent conditions, working conditions for archaeologists, and the big support we get from the local authorities to carry out this research. We started with conducting a large-scale archaeological survey. Here you can see the borders of this survey. So it borders the frontier to Turkey, slightly also the triangle of the three countries, Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. And then the southwestern border is the Tigris River, especially the Mosul Dam, which has been constructed in the 1980s in this region. Bazetki actually was documented within our survey, and what we found is that Bazetki is the largest urban site of the Bronze Age, which we could identify in this area. It is located in the middle of a plain, which is called the Silivani Plain. So it's one of the plains in the eastern Tigridian region. So it's bordered by the Tigris to the west and by the first range of the Zagros Mountains to the east. So this Silivani Plain always showed a lot of occupation, a lot of settlements during all periods, and especially during the Bronze Age. So Bazetki is more or less in the center of this plain and can be considered as a central place during at least the early and the middle Bronze Age, but as we also know now, during the late Bronze Age for this region, the Silivani Plain. I already said that the site can be considered an urban site due to its distinction into a upper city, a mound proper, and then a vast area which we could identify as a lower city. You can see this even in the corona images of the 1960s, a bit more clear. We can see the outline of a wall, which is interestingly rectangular, but also an outer area, this slightly whitish area which surrounds the central mound, which at that time already still contained a Kurdish village on top of it, which was later destroyed, and a military basis from the Saddam period was erected at the site of the ancient Kurdish village. So these already gives you also an idea of the different excavation areas which we had chosen for excavations. These excavation activities started in 2015, and we've been conducting until now 6 seasons of excavations in areas A, B, C, and E. Area D is still waiting, so we hope to start Area D in this coming season, which is going to take place now in August and September of this year. Let me start with the most important discovery of our excavations, because this is kind of opening up the scene, as this discovery enables us to identify the city with an old city. So in Area C, we discovered an archive jar dating to the Middle Assyrian period, and it proved to be an archive of a person called Ashur Natsir, who was the governor Bilpachete of a city called Mardama. And so obviously, as this is a governor's seat, there was a province called Mardama, which was located in the area around Bazetki. So that is interesting for several respects. I will come back to this point later. So the main importance of it is that we are now able to identify Bazetki with the ancient city of Mardama or Mardaman. This city, Mardaman, has been mentioned in cuneiform texts, so we knew about the existence of the city, and especially Dominique Charpin and Edith Ziegler have written, and others also have written about its possible locations. So the earliest attestation goes back to the Akkadian time, when there is a year name in the reign of Naram-Sin, which is labeled Year of the Conquest of Maridaban, and philologists agreed on the fact that Maridaban would be the same as later Mardaban. So that is the first appearance of Maridaban, Mardaban in the philological sources. And we will come back to this point later. This is also a time which is interesting because at Bazetki itself, there was found this famous statue, basis of the time of Naram-Sin, with an inscription which I will talk more about it later. So that connects these two incidences. So then then in the third dynasty of Ur, Mardaman is mentioned in texts from southern Mesopotamia. So Mardaman was obviously in contact with the Ur III empire in the south, and especially in the old Babylonian period, we know about Mardaman from the Mari archives. We have different texts throwing a light on Mardaman, for example, as physicians have been ordered or requested from Mardaman to come to Mari. We know about a king with the name of Tish-Ulme, who was the king of Mardaman in the time of the Mari archives. So we know, we already knew that it must be a rather important city in the northeasternmost part of Mesopotamia. Finally, the Middle Assyrian archive, which we found, proves that Mardama, it lost its N as you can see, Mardama existed in the Middle Assyrian period and was the seat of a Middle Assyrian province. So that demonstrates the long continuity of the existence of the life of the city of Mardaman. And interestingly, this is mirrored by the stratigraphical record, which we could establish in our excavations, especially in areas A and area C. So you can see that all these periods which have philological evidence also have archaeological evidence, such as the Akkadian period, the Middle Bronze Age, and of course especially also the Middle Assyrian period. So this gives us an excellent chance to combine historical data and archaeological data. And I will outline this historical development of the city of Mardaman according to a number of stages. I will shortly start with stage one, which considers the time before the Akkadian period, so the early Bronze Age or the third millennium BC. And this is a very important period at Bazetki, because as you can see here, we have a very long sequence of occupation throughout the whole third millennium. It starts very early in the third millennium, in the early Ninevite 5 period, according to C14 data, shortly after 3000, and continues all the way into what is considered to be the Akkadian period in level 15. So 27 to 15 is the sequence, and this could be then subdivided, slightly similar to what we know about the chronology of Syria, of the Syrian Jezire. In the third millennium, we were able to subdivide this development of the pottery mainly into periods EMT1 to EMT5. EMT means early Middle Tigridian, because it's a very specific area with a specific material culture, especially in the third millennium, distinguishable from regions further east into the Erbil and Sulaymaniyah regions. Okay, then stage two is of course the Akkadian period. We will see what kind of archaeological evidence we have. Then the large focus will be on the Middle Bronze Age, on the old Babylonian period. And finally, I will move on to the Middle Assyrian period. Let me just start with stage one, just in a very short and summary way to have more time left for the other periods of the second millennium. So the stage one is kind of a prelude to this history. It is the period when the city was established, was formed. We have evidence of these long processes, as just shown in this chronological chart. From excavation area A, which is this, there's a very long step trench covering all relevant occupation periods of the site. And in the meantime, we were able to extend this original step trench into several larger areas to have a bigger exposure about specific periods which are of special interest for us. The earliest attestation is dating to the early part of the Ninevite Five period, and what we have here in our oldest faces is the remains of a city wall with the city gate, and that shows that the place was started to be fortified in the beginning of the third millennium. So it is quite important in view of the discussions about urbanization processes of the third millennium. Was there a second urbanization after kind of a interruption in the Ninevite Five period? At the base of our investigations, we would say that it does not reflect a second urbanization process, but rather hints at a continuous urbanization from the late Chalcolithic into the third millennium BC. Even at that time, in this early Ninevite Five periods, we have houses built outside of the city wall. The city wall is seen in the back here of this trench, outside, which shows that the settlement had already developed outside of the limits of the original fortification system. So a kind of increasing intensity of urbanization, we might say. So what we conclude from this prelude is that the site, although we don't know whether it was already called Mardaman and when this name came into existence, we see that from the early third millennium onwards, there was a continuous urban development. And this also, as I said, throws light on the fact this early period is not something pre-urban as often is maintained, but is an actual urban phase. So the second stage is the Akkadian period, and so this is the first imperial encounter of this central place in the Silivani plain, because obviously it got into contact with the Akkadian empire and the Akkadian expansion. Our most important evidence for this is the Bazetki statue base, which was, just to point out, for those of you who might not know, was not found in our excavations. It was found years before, in the 1970s, during road constructions at Bazetki. The statue was brought to Baghdad and is kept at the Baghdad National Museum, and is important for mainly two things. First, it is an excellent masterpiece of Akkadian sculpture, although only the lower part of the statue has been preserved, but the naturalistic rendering of the legs and feet of the statue is extraordinary, especially with regard to the material copper. The second importance is its inscription, which, as you can see here in Frayn's translation, marks an important event in the history of Mesopotamia in general, because, I don't read all of this now, as a consequence of victorious battles which Naram-Sin fought, they, as it is pretended, the citizens of the city requested that Naram-Sin is made a god of their city and built a temple for Naram-Sin within the city of Agade. So the question always was, why did this statue base appear at Bazetki? We would suppose that it should appear at a site which then we could call Agade, but it did not. So what does it do? What is the context of this? statue bases, and what does it mean for this city of Mardaban or Maridaban, as it is mentioned in the Akkadian texts. So the evidence for the Akkadian period we have is first on located in our excavation area A on the mound. It's a large building surrounded by a very heavy stone foundation with an entrance with a paveled vestibule first, and then the proper entrance here with the door sockets into the building, which was unfortunately rather destroyed. So this building is something more than a normal house, which is clear, kind of an official building, but unfortunately we do not yet know what kind of building this might have been, what function it could have had. And of course, something we don't know is whether this is an Akkadian building in a proper sense. So was it built by the Akkadians, or was it a local building built in the time of the Akkadians? And the later, the second option is the most plausible one, because we do not have any evidence of a direct connection to the Akkadian Empire. So we consider this a local official building in the time of Akkadeh. This is the entrance into that building, and the access to this entrance was coming directly up from this lower city. So at the same time, this building was at the connection point between the lower city and the upper city, at the access point to the upper city, with a street leading around this building and going up onto the higher parts of the mound. This is this street beside the building, which is in the background. The street was interesting because there was a deposit of broken pottery, broken walls, so broken mud bricks, was burned evidences. So this is the remains of a destructive event. And the material obviously comes from the adjoining buildings and fell then into the street. So there might have been kind of a destruction event in the Akkadian period. This brings us, of course, back to what I mentioned, that we know a year name from the period of Naram-Sin, which says the year when Maridaban was conquered. So there might be the possibility that this is destruction is somehow connected to this conquest by Naram-Sin, but of course this is just a pure guess. We have no evidence in itself that this event can be connected to the Akkadians. What we have is radiocarbon data, which clearly indicate that we are in the 23rd century BC with this destructive event. Also interesting evidence for the Akkadian period comes from a huge pit. We call it Ali's Pit because this is one of the foremen who worked in this part. And it is interesting because it contained a huge number of potteries together with charcoal, together with animal bones. So a huge refuse pit with a kind of pottery which was very specialized. This is this typical North Mesopotamian Akkadian period potteries known from Teltaya and other sites. And we always have them in our Akkadian levels, but at this pit, there was mainly, or a large majority of this very fine vessels which were broken and deposited in this pit. So a very specific kind of context, and we think that this is refuse of some communal feasting events which was regularly carried out, so that was regularly dumped material in this pit. Also in the same pit was this votive figurine, which stratigraphically can be dated to the Akkadian period. An interesting figurine in the way of it's the hairs, which show very interesting kind of hair gear with these curls. So maybe kind of a rendering like a curly hero, which is a representation we know, of course, from this period, and which we think was also behind or was also connected to this former statue of Naram, of the Naram-Sin basis. So a very stylized rendering of a six curly, six-curled hero with a strange face, maybe human, maybe animal, so, and it's broken, so maybe this is a broken figurine which was used in these events from which the refuse stems. So was used, was kind of broken probably during these communal feasting activities and then came into the same refuse pit. So that could hint at the point that this communal feasting had some kind of ritual aspects in it. So the question, of course, is where did this, what was the context of the Naram-Sin statue bases as the local people? And we have quite reliable informants and asked different persons, especially the mayor of the neighboring city who was present in 1976 when the statue bases came up. He pointed out to us that, interestingly, it was not found in the on the mound itself, but at one point here, exactly where this street was built. And first we were puzzled by this fact that it was found outside, but then realized that according to the corona images and our survey results, it would be exactly the position I think was a city gate of the lower city located. So that means the general context of the statue bases could have been a city gate. We opened up a trench an excavation area in this part where the statue bases was found, and we came up with an interesting stratigraphy consisting of mainly two periods. Middle Bronze Age occupation on the top, and immediately below it an Akkadian occupation. So that was an interesting, was the first kind of important result to see, okay, there is Akkadian levels at this point. We also could see where the statue base is and how it was found, because when the road was built, a bulldozer made a huge cut, and this is the cut line of the bulldozer trench here. And so there was this kind of wide passage was cut into the area where the city wall ran originally. And so that is the point and the place where the statue bases must have come out, must have appeared. What we have just beside of this cut, here is the cut. You can see how the layers have been cut away by this bulldozer cut. What we have inside is an Akkadian pebbled floor, very long. So we suppose it's a street. A pebbled street, and at the end of this pebbled street is a huge monolithic threshold of stone, and this threshold is just in the line of the Middle Bronze Age city wall. So that is why we consider that this threshold was part of an Akkadian city gate, and that would then mean that the statue bases, although we do not yet know its exact position, was somehow connected to this city gate of the lower city in the during the Akkadian period. Nearby on the fields, we found also two objects which we can date to the second half of the third millennium, these bronze spearheads, one of the few objects which we can until now connect to that period in consideration. So to sum up for the Akkadian period, what we think Marie Daban was important for was its geographical position in relation to Akkad, so be it somewhere around Samarra. Bazetki could have functioned as for the Akkadian expansion, as kind of a node in a street or communication network from there, sites such as Pir Hussein with this famous statue or relief, and also Tel Brak with the Naram Sin palace could have been reached. So we also think that Naram Sin might have conquered it as a strategic point and also as a point to concentrate tributes from these areas in the north. And that's could have been one of the backgrounds, one of the reasons why there was this statue being erected. Probably there were several copies of such a statue, which we could expect at Akkad itself. And these copies in the Akkadian time could have distributed over several strategic points of the empire, kind of a demarcation of physical, visual demarcation of the conquests of the Akkadian expansion. Okay, so now let's come to stage three, the Old Babylonian period, which is a period where we can see that Mardaman was involved in interregional trade and had a very clear urban planning. So what we have done to investigate urban planning was, of course, to carry out geomagnetic prospection in the lower city. And quite interesting results came up from this geomagnetic prospection. We always carried out surface surveys on the site of the geomagnetic prospections. And to sum up, always when I now point out what we have in this geomagnetic, we found the majority of sherds dating to the Middle Bronze Age. So that is a clear indication that these structures visible in the geomagnetic prospection actually date to the Middle Bronze Age, which is the Old Babylonian period in general, which of course does not say that the site was part of the Old Babylonian Empire. Shortly at least it might have been, but not, of course not over all this time. So Old Babylonian means just a general chronological framework for that period. So in the northwestern corner, where we can see from the corona images that there must have been kind of an angle of a city wall, and it's very interesting that the city wall has very straight lines, so it was not a rounded city, and for this reason we think that there was a kind of urban urban reorganization of the site, which meant that, among others, a rectangular outer city wall was constructed. In the corner, here is the corner, there is a huge building of the Middle Bronze Age, probably connected to a city gate, might be, or some larger structure here, just on the line of the city wall. So that may be an indication of kind of an administrative building which was put into this corner, a northwestern corner of the city, of the lower city. In the excavation area where we investigated the place of discovery of the Naram-Sin statue base, which I showed you already before, and where we have good indication from the geomagnetic image that the city wall ran through, we actually found remains of a very heavy stone foundation, largely destroyed by agricultural activities because it's so closely below the modern surface. But this is just in the line of the city, so we think that this is the stone foundation of this Middle Bronze Age city wall around the lower city. Just inside of the city wall, in the same area, we came across another interesting building which we partly excavated, a building which is characterized by several large storage vessels of different shapes, these vats here, and then also cylindrical vessels, and then also closed storage vessels. They were deposited in rows of this building, as you can see here. So this is obviously a storage building dating to the Middle Bronze Age, which was erected immediately behind and adjoining to the city wall, near to the place where this city gate of the Akkadian period has been located. So this could be kind of a economic building, and the position close to a city gate and close to a city wall might be indicative of a building which probably was in connection with commerce, with trade. And we know from texts which were found at Külte Pekanisch that Mardaman was a station on the route of the merchants from Ashur to Kültepe in central Anatolia and Cappadocia. This commercial activities which could be behind the storage activities here probably were in connection with this importance of the site as a commercial note on the important trade routes between Assyria and Anatolia. Further south, or in the central western part of the lower city here, we identified several other interesting buildings. A larger building here, which of course is difficult to identify, and then here two clearly visible houses of nearly square shape next to each other with courtyards, so indicating larger houses and households in the lower city, among others, which we have streets and so on, and other smaller areas, so showing that this lower city, and in between, no results in the geomagnetic, probably due to sedimentation. So in all it shows, and this is the outline of the city wall, in all it shows that this city, the lower city, was densely occupied and quite regularly structured in the Middle Bronze Age. This is the a larger scale of these two houses, which I already mentioned. You can clearly identify the rooms. You can see this is a central courtyard, a large hall along the central courtyard, two other halls on the two sides of the courtyard, two more halls in the rear part, and also this house, although less clear, seems to have had the same kind of outline, ground plan, with a central court and halls around the central courtyard. When we compare this, it seems evident that this is quite typical old Babylonian houses, as we know them from Nippur, but we know them also from Larsa. So these old Babylonian houses always have this courtyard in the middle, and then a large hall at the side of the courtyard, surrounded by smaller rooms on the other sides of the courtyard. What is important and impressive is the size of these houses. So this, which we call the big house, has a size of 530 meters, and what we call the small house has still an area of 225 hectares. So compared to the Nippur houses, which are mostly much smaller, it shows that these houses must have been houses of some important households. What is the idea we have is that these are households which were connected to the trade activities of the old Babylonian period, so especially households which might have been related to the Cappadocian trade and had been these middlemen, which are recorded from Kultepet tablets, middlemen which were located at Mardaman and which stored part of the trade goods, such as tin at Mardama, something which is also clear from one of the Kültepe texts. So that's why we, as you can imagine, intend to excavate also in this area to prove this hypothesis. This is what is excavation area D, which we did not just have time to start, and hopefully in this summer we will have the chance to start to work in this part of the lower city to get a clearer picture of the old Babylonian layout and function of the lower city, and a clearer picture about trade activities at Mardaman in this period of the old Babylonian / old Assyrian period. So this is here mainly focusing on the old Assyrian aspect of this region. That means the old Assyrian trade networks, not politically now, just economically, of course. Yes, so what do we know about the old Babylonian period from the upper city? Unfortunately, less than we do from the lower city. What we have in the upper city is a fortification wall enceinte, kind of a surrounding wall of the top plateau of the upper city. Inside this surrounding wall, we found a huge open area without any building, without any architectural layers, just the floor. It was a bit of disappointing, as we could not extend this excavation area. There's a lot of Islamic levels on top, so it's not easy to extend this excavation area. What we had hoped to get there is, of course, kind of official buildings dating to this period, of the Hurrian kingdom of Mardaman, which we know from the Mari text. We know, as I already said, this ruler Chishulma with a Hurrian name. So we were hoping about to get across a maybe palatial structure of this period. And it is still not excluded because, I mean, there's a fortification, there's an open area, and of course that could mean that a larger structure is just behind the bulk, but unfortunately we have no chance to excavate it. What we did find is two old Babylonian tablets, or fragments of tablets, which were found here in connection with this fortification wall. One of them is interesting because it mentions a big shipment of grain. In a quantity, I don't now remember, Bettina Feist should know, I don't remember what quantity, but a substantial quantity of grain which was delivered. And that is obviously part of an institutional delivery of grain. So that could be a slight indication that we might have an administrative building behind this open area. But that's unfortunately all what we can say about this upper city in the old Babylonian period. What we find also in this area is a very nice cylinder seal, which is interesting in the fact that iconographically and stylistically it very much resembles the so-called old Assyrian style, which is best documented in the ceilings from Kültepe Kanish. Of course, we have also some of these seals found at Ashur itself, but the largest part of this seal was found in the Karum of Kültepe. So this is kind of these seals which were favored and which were used by Assyrian merchants at that time, which does not mean necessarily, of course, that this seal must have also been the seal of a merchant, but at least from the style closely connected to the Karum at Kanish, we have some more clues, some more hints in the direction of an involvement of Mardaman in the Cappadocian trade. And well, the stylistic features, I mean, is the way of rendering the headdress, this typical rendering of the faces of this figure, and other details, these two figures on top of each other. Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to the lower city again for the old Babylonian period. In the southern part of the lower city, we see the limits of the city here. This is the trace of the city wall, and you can see buildings inside and free area outside. No occupation, no architecture outside. What was astonishing was that there's a very huge structure in the geomagnetic picture, which is a straight line. You can follow it up to here, and most clearly here, then very strongly articulated in the middle part. And we had no clue what this structure could have been, and because it was outside of the city and it was something parallel to the city. So first we thought maybe it's kind of a second fortification or other things. So we decided to open an excavation area to get a clear image of what that was. And that was especially urgent as this area was the place where the new highway was constructed, which was going around the site of Bazetki. So we were under time pressure and did this excavations here. You can see that the building machines already started to prepare the road, and so we hurried up to excavate this area, which was so significant signal in the geomagnetic picture. Interestingly, it was a pavement of shirts, a linear pavement of shirts, which we could follow over a distance of more than 120 meters. It is about 5 meters wide and absolutely straight. So that is a pavement of what we consider to have been a street which was not inside the city, but a street which was outside of the city. So a regional street, we might say, not an urban street. And it was kind of bypassing Madaman. As you can remember from the geomagnetic image, it was going parallel to the southern city wall. So that is a very interesting feature. And the ideas which we have in connection with the streets, so the shirts are perfectly and exclusively Middle Bronze, so the date, there's no question about the date. The idea behind this extra urban street is that this could have been actually part of a road network of the old Babylonian period, and the way it goes would rather fit to the main road which we assume to have existed in the old Assyrian trade network, so a road coming from Assyria leading up to Anatolia. Of course, we don't think that the road was paved with shirts all over this long distance, but probably just in the area of a larger city, it was paved with shirts for whatever reason. At the side limit of this paved area, there were a lot of urns, so pottery jars dug into the ground, which contained cremations, burnt bones, cremation burials, and we found altogether 16 cremation urns along the street, also dating to the Middle Bronze Age, and that is interesting because cremation is something usually regularly not known from Mesopotamia in the old Babylonian period. It is rather strange to Mesopotamia, both southern and northern Mesopotamia. But it is, on the other hand, very familiar to Anatolia in the Middle Bronze Age. So we have several cremation burials in central and western Anatolia in the Middle Bronze Age. So what that could mean is that we might see this as an additional evidence of some kind of connection between Madaman and Anatolia. Be it people coming from Anatolia with this cremation habits being burned here, or some other kind of influence from Anatolia here at this point of communication in the northeasternmost part of Mesopotamia. So again, to figure out what we think is that this is the city wall proper, this is this extra urban east-west street. There's a second line in the magnetic picture, which also these are our excavation trenches to follow up these anomalies in the magnetic picture. So that proved to be another paved road, and that proved to be a small square paved with shirts. So that means there's a linear street, a small place, and then a road going up into the city and through the city gate. So a kind of a connection of this external road into the city. So a branching of a Nebenstraße, as we would say in German. And again, on the outside, so the cremation urns were here. On the outside, there were normal burials, which are inhumation burials of the usual northern Mesopotamian type. So this is the general picture which we have. This is area B. This is where this road is. And you can see it is kind of a crazy coincidence that at exactly that point where they planned the new highway going to Turkey, this is the E5 from Baghdad to Istanbul, exactly at this point below this new highway, this evidence came up. So maybe this can be an indication of a very continuous, continuously used place of a road, which is somehow indicated also by geography, because it is the best place. We in our survey, we see that the valleys, the wadis, sometimes are deep, sometimes are shallow. When the wadis are deep, it's difficult to have a road. So that's a perfect line of a road where you would also expect it. Okay, so that's for the Old Babylonian, Old Assyrian period. So we see that Mardaman, based on Kültepe tablets, was a station on the road from Aşur on the eastern side of the Tigris, interestingly, to Kültepe, and this road must have continued through the Tur Abdin, through the upper Tigris part, and then through this different plain of Malatya, plain of Elbistan, to finally to Kültepe Kanish. So we can conclude that Madaman, as a Hurrian kingdom of the Middle Bronze Age, as attested from Mari texts, was probably a node in the old Assyrian trade networks of that period, or slightly earlier than the Mari text, of course, like the 19th, 18th centuries BC. Okay, finally, we come to stage four, the last phase of which I want to show you some more evidence in detail. How did Madaman look in the Middle Assyrian period when the city was a provincial capital of the Middle Assyrian Empire? First, we have to say that the city shrank considerably, while in the Middle Bronze Age, all the lower city, and this is the place here, this is the place where this excavation area E was located, where the statue base was found, all this huge area of the Middle Bronze Age city was abandoned, and in the Middle Assyrian period, only the mound itself remained to be occupied. The Middle Assyrian and also Neo-Assyrian layers were uncovered in excavation area C, which is on the east flank of the mound, and you can see here that excavation area just also beside this road from the 1970s. So the most important architectural features came up in phase C9, dated to the Middle Assyrian period, and this is where the Middle Assyrian cuneiform tablets were found. It's a large building, which we assume to be the Middle Assyrian governor's residence. We don't say governor's palace because it's not clear what character of use this building had. Was it kind of a private residence where the governor also carried out its official businesses, or was it an official governor's building? It's difficult to decide, and we have the idea that these kind of governors, which was maybe a governor of a smaller province of the Middle Assyrian Empire, actually resided in his residence and carried out his official duties within and from his residence. So this is an aerial view of how this building of this governor's residence looked like. Of course, it's datable according to the tablets to the time of Shalmaneser I and to Kulti-Ninurta I. So we are here in the second half of the 13th and the beginning of the 12th century BC. So this is what we know until now about this building. There is a large hall, which probably was in the middle, because this building continues in the eastern direction. So what we have in mind is that it might reflect a Mittelsaal house, so a central hall plan, which is not unknown from the Middle Assyrian period, because like the big residence at Tel Sabi Abiad was also this middle hall building type. Beside the middle hall, there were long rooms which were later subdivided. These are later introductions. Was later subdivided in single rooms, so 1, 2, 3, probably 4 long rooms on this side. And well, we can guess that 1, 2, or more of these rooms were also going into the opposite side of this central hall. Now, interestingly, cuneiform tablets mentioning the Ashurnasir's activities were found in several parts. So this is the areas where we found tablets. So that means that's not one archive room, but it's kind of activities documented in cuneiform tablets which were spread over not the whole building, but over several rooms of this building. Large stars mean many tablets, small stars mean few tablets. Altogether, we have now approximately 500 tablets or fragments of tablets, and that's quite a good starting point for a new consideration of how provincial governance was organized in the Middle Assyrian period. So after Assur, obviously, which has the largest material available in Karakalpakstan, we have Tel Shihamet as the second largest archive, and that is a provincial archive, and now Madaman as the third largest Middle Assyrian archive for provincial activities. So there's room I, where this archive jar, which you saw in the first picture, was located. Room AN to the side of it, where also more than 200 tablets came up, and then single tablets coming up in the central hall and in one of the other long rooms. So this is an impression of this long central hall here, unfortunately also disturbed by later pits. Room I, which has this largest amount of tablets, room AN with the second largest amount of tablets. Some more tablets have been discovered here, but these rooms have not yet been excavated. They were just cleared from the top, so that will be done in this season. Room I was very interesting because it contained a broken inventory, so this governor's seat was abandoned and suddenly abandoned at one special time. You can see a lot of broken storage jars lying on the floors, bowls, a faience bowl here, and then tablets on several parts of the floor, like these two. So a huge disarrangement, which hints at a sudden abandonment of this governor's residence. Within this room, within the same room I, there was this area of three nearly complete jars, one, two, three, and these jars were surrounded by a small heap of clay, so they were covered. And this is a trench which we opened into this small mound. So that means when this site was abandoned, when the governor's residence was abandoned, these jars were kind of sealed, were buried under this heap of clay. And you can see that this clay was put out when the inventory was already broken. So when these troubled activities were already going on or in the middle. So one of these three jars was the archive jar. And what Bettina Feist found out is that these archive jar contained documents which were Shulmanu documents, so documents which had an interest for the governor, where the governor had still things which were so-called debts, which were for him. So that was important, obviously, for him personally. And that's why that could be the reason that he, or under his advice, this storage, this archive jar was covered below this mound of earth in order to retrieve it at a later point, and then he could reclaim the depths which are mentioned in the tablet. So this is the idea, this is the interpretation we have. It never happened that he came back. It never happened, obviously, that this central administration was revitalized at this point. And that's why this mound stayed as it is and the archive jar inside stayed as it was. So luckily for us, but badly for this governor. And that shows that Middle Assyrian dominance must have suddenly come to an end during the time of Tukulti-Ninurta I, which is strange, but which is maybe explainable due to the position of Madaman as the northernmost province. It was the northern border province of the Middle Assyrian Empire, close to the Zagros Mountains. So invaders from north or even local people could maybe get access to this province more easily than into a central province. And that shows at least kind of an instability of the Middle Assyrian Empire within its main phase of expansion, the time of Tukulti-Ninurta I. So this is the governor's archive with his tablets, 65 tablets, which were found in this jar. And other tablets, as I said, were just found on the floor. Interestingly, not only on the last floor, as we then found out, but there were four earlier floors, mud floors, which always contained tablets. So that shows that activities were carried out, new floors were made, tablets were again written and discarded on the floor. So it is proof of a continuous activity of administration within this building. The tablets are quite fragmentary, as you can see, and it was very delicate to excavate them, as you also can see here from these pictures. Several of the tablets were lying closely together, adjoining each other, but not surrounded by a container like a pottery jar. But that shows, or it could be an indication, that it was an organic container in which these tablets were once stored. So that means not only pottery jars, but also containers of reed, like a basket or something, could have been used to contain tablets like these 1, 2, 3, 4, which are lying just close to each other. Well, some of the fragments had to be taken out in blocks, because due to the fragmentary state, and then they were conserved or excavated and conserved by our conservators in the house, and then directly read by Bettina Feist. Finally, the tablets were handed over to the National Museum of Duhok, where they are stored at the moment and been further studied in the next years. Administration and writing activities was not the only activity in this building, as in the same room, there was a metal working place. So there's a fireplace with a lot of metal slag remains. Just beside this fireplace, at a short distance, there was a mold for casting a bronze axe, as you can see here. Socketed axe, and that means that metalworking, smiths working, was another activity in this governor's residence, so it was also kind of a workshop. Again, this bronze dagger was found very closely to this fireplace, and again, it could be evidence that, or an indication, that this kind of dagger was also fabricated in the workshop in this room I, which has an inlay of ivory, badly preserved, as you can see here in the handle. What else do we have? We have a lot of faience objects, sintered quartz objects, typical bowls of the Middle Assyrian period, a zigatu, then circular beads, or what is it, knöpfe? Knobs made of faience, so the typical inventory of Middle Assyrian sintered quartz objects in a quantity which also hints at the possibility, at least, that sintered quartz objects were produced within this governor's residence. More of these examples here. So this is harness of a horse, and then this colored sintered quartz bowl from the same area. This is from room AN. And room I. So interestingly, in the room adjoining to room I, there was this kind of very strange oven installation with open areas between like blocks of mud bricks with burnt surfaces inside. So it was not a pottery kiln, obviously, a different kind of pyrotechnical installation. Interestingly, we found traces of slag of sintered quartz in this area behind. So we think that this was an oven installation to produce sintered quartz objects, which would then mean that these objects which we find were not objects which were used in this residence, but which were produced in the residence. So another indication of the function of this residence, this governor's place, as a workshop area. And finally, one of the nicest objects is an object which is made of ivory, as Annie Cobé figured out on the base of the photos. It's elephant ivory, and it's a very unique piece for the Middle Assyrian period. It's a calf's head, which is finely carved here, some incisions for hairs, and the details of eye and nose and mouth. Interestingly, it is cut on its rear side. There is a hole in the backside showing that it was attached to another object. The question, what kind of object was it? And we are quite sure that it's kind of a stool or throne, such as this throne from the relief of Nimrud, dating to the time of Ashurnasirpal II. You can see a stool with just the same kind of calf's head attached to it, so that would need the same kind of attachment facility inside. So, interestingly, as the style and function is so, or style and outlook is so similar, these pieces which we know from reliefs and also from real objects date to the Near Assyrian period, while our object is Middle Assyrian, and that is an interesting indication of the strong continuity of Middle Assyrian art into Neo-Assyrian art. So to conclude, this piece, I don't think that this governor, this kind of a mediocre governor in a small northern province, had a throne which was ornate, which was ornated in the royal style by these calf heads. I would rather guess that also this object was something which was produced here in these workshops in order to be delivered to Ashur or to Kartukulti-Ninurta. So another indication of a production, specialized production for royal purposes. So finally, what we know now for the Middle Assyrian period is that Madama was a provincial seat. It has a governor. The province is not clearly defined by the text, but we can argue that by our survey results that it is more or less covering the Selivani plain up to the Tigris. Interestingly, the border must have been the Jebel Bichir, the first mountain range of the Zagros, because behind that mountain, in our survey, and we very carefully looked and searched for it, there was no single Middle Assyrian pottery shirt. So it's a clear demarcation of the Middle Assyrian Empire on the basis of this kind of pottery. So that shows that Madaman was really the northern border province of the Middle Assyrian Empire, and at the same time, not only a border, but also a connecting line to provinces further up on the Tigris, on the upper Tigris, such as Tushhan in nowadays Turkey, and probably the same kind of roads were used to come to the upper Tigris region, the Middle Assyrian provinces in the upper Tigris region, the same kind of roads which were already active in the old Babylonian period, and maybe this was the most or largest importance of this province of Madama as a communication way to control the southeastern Anatolian areas of the Middle Assyrian Empire. So that's the end of it, the end of this four stages story. I want to thank you for your attention. And of course, I always am very happy to thank all my members of the team, the students, the local workers, the local authorities from De Hoek, which so strongly support us and without whom our project and our results would not have been made possible. Thank you.